Okay, so I get to talk today about one of the final chapters in the Vimalakirti Sutra, which we've been studying throughout this practice period. I don't know if there are going to be any further talks on this sutra. Yes? Good. Okay. Because the best parts are yet to come. But this chapter, which is about entering the gate of non-dualism, is a good chapter too. And it's got a pretty exciting climax. And so we've started out with bodhisattvas and disciples who are a little bit nervous about being shown up by the lay person, Vimalakirti. And we've seen psychedelic scenes with thousands of beings occupying Vimalakirti's little sick room to a gender-fluid goddess. So it's been quite an adventure. The nature of the storytelling itself could be seen as using a skillful means to share the Dharma. In the days before movies, a sutra that could offer so much drama, fantasy, humor, and wisdom could attract some attention among a whole bunch of spiritual leaders that happened to be around at the time. I'm not sure if anyone else has brought this up during the practice period in their teachings, but there's also a good prequel to the story, so the movie series can continue. Apparently, it was Nagarjuna who discovered the sutra after being led by dragons to the Dragon King's palace at the bottom of the ocean. So, Jason Momoa, you know? Yeah. Could be, like, down in the water. The sutra, however, deals with the most serious of topics, which is how we might relieve suffering and our deeply distressed, or maybe since it's Halloween tomorrow, scary world. Vimalakirti, the extraordinary, ordinary man, said, "I am sick because the whole world is sick." And he speaks to us from his 10 by 10 foot room, which is the stage for the drama of the sutra. The teaching by the Buddha at the beginning of the sutra describes some of the first steps one can take to create the healing balm which will soothe the suffering of the world. After providing the crowd with a glimpse of a great heavenly realm, the Buddha teaches the steps for cultivation of a wholesome path. This includes practicing the six paramitas, or perfections, which are generosity, fairness, tolerance, energy, mindfulness, and wisdom. The four heavenly abodes, or immeasurables, which are living by love, compassion, joy, and impartiality, and cultivating the aspiration for enlightenment. Buddha then turns the teaching over to the wise Vimalakirti, who is visited grudgingly by Buddha's disciples and a range of bodhisattvas. So what I'll talk about today is the chapter near the end of the sutra. I don't know if any of you are referring to the online translations, but it seems to be chapter 8 in the most recent translations, but there is an old translation, which I also was using originally, where it's chapter 9. So I'm not quite sure how things got divided, but just in case you're looking. So the subsequent chapters, which will form the talks later on, are like the big celebratory party where everyone gets to eat heavenly food made of perfume. Not sure what Michelin would do with that. This chapter is where the various bodhisattvas and disciples describe their understanding of non-duality, or the non-separation of self from other. It makes sense to me that this would be one of the final chapters, because all of the practices, such as the practice of the paramitas or the four immeasurables, actually flow naturally if one deeply understands non-duality and the non-separation of things. Realizing the emptiness of self or self-nature is also the basis for much, if not all, of Mahayana practice. You hear it in the many sutras we chant, the Heart Sutra, harmony of difference and equality, and many others. So I feel a little bit intimidated by this, that I have to talk about such an important topic, and I'm not quite sure if I will be able to convey everything you need to be enlightened by the end of this, but you know, maybe I can offer a little bit of light. So in this chapter of the sutra, 32 bodhisattvas are asked by Vimalakirti to offer their understanding of non-duality. I'll describe a bit about how Vimalakirti has already demonstrated complete realization of non-duality throughout the sutra, and then share some of the responses given by the bodhisattvas. I'll end by describing Vimalakirti's thunderous silence near the end of the chapter, which is seen by some as the highlight of the sutra. So true comprehension of non-duality underlies all of Vimalakirti's life and teaching. Throughout the sutra, we've seen this demonstrated in the impressive example of Vimalakirti's life. He is a lay person, as wise and well-spoken as any bodhisattva. He cultivates a non-dualistic practice by deeply encountering all dimensions of human experience, not just monastic life. He is shown offering his life to others. He is a successful and wealthy business person who, after providing for himself and his family, uses his money to help others. He works in government to influence actions which will benefit the greatest number of people. He hangs out in the taverns, not separating himself from what others might consider immoral or unhealthy activity, because it gets him closer to people who could really use his help. The sutra says that he hoped to serve as a bridge and ladder to everyone to free themselves from the destructive dualistic views of I and mine. So how did he get to this place? Presumably he started out as an ordinary human being like you or I. It seems that Vimalakirti gradually overcame the isolating duality of his own narrow self-understanding. He began to recognize in his own suffering, his own human suffering, the suffering of everyone. And it became only natural to enter into life fully with others to help free them. He realized that helping others requires understanding the people he's trying to help. With this, he demonstrated and cultivated the non-dualistic nature of practice through his life. But what would this look like in our own practice? At first, we usually undertake Buddhist practices, the practices of the paramitas, the immeasurables, the precepts to relieve our own suffering. I think the long-term effect of these practices, though, is to soften our feeling that there is a hard and fast self. We see how the various emotions, ideas, or memories of the past float by like clouds in our mind. This tends to loosen one's self-absorption, and one begins to see how one's own suffering is tied to the suffering of the whole world. We really get a sense of how our feeling of separation from others and the world is itself the cause of much of our own suffering. This you-me dichotomy is not just unhelpful, it's painful. And as we become aware of this, it seems that our freedom from suffering actually requires a deep concern for the health and wellness of everyone and everything. I think it may take us some time to reach that point and to reach Vimalakirti's realization, but we all have to start somewhere, right? Vimalakirti understands non-duality deeply, and so this chapter of the sutra begins with him asking the bodhisattvas to explain how they enter the Dharma door of non-duality. 31 bodhisattvas plus the bodhisattva of wisdom Manjushri all offer their replies. Each one of those replies is actually a deep meditation, a non-duality, and each could be studied separately at length. I've chosen a few and will discuss what they say to me or what I take from them about non-duality. And a lot of these bodhisattvas have very elaborate names, so hopefully I don't stumble across them or stumble through them, but I actually like the challenge, so I'll do my best here. So the first one is great. The bodhisattva Dharmavikravana declared, "Noble sir, production and destruction are two, but what is not produced and does not occur cannot be destroyed. Thus the attainment of the tolerance of birthlessness of things is the entrance into non-duality." So this sounds to me suspiciously like the scientific law of the conservation of mass, which asserts that in a closed system, matter may change form, but the weight of its resulting form or parts, remains the same. Experiments to demonstrate this were done in around the 18th century. But this concept has been around in philosophical thought for much longer. I looked at my almost favorite source, Wikipedia cites this idea in Jain philosophy arising around 520 before the Common Era, and Greek philosophy in the 4th century BCE, which states that nothing comes from nothing. More modern concepts of special relativity have refined these ideas, but the result is pretty much the same. I heard our founding teacher, Norman, talk about another teacher, Ajahn Chah, holding a cup of tea and saying, "This cup is already broken. Its whole existence is already here." Ajahn Chah wasn't worried about losing it if it were to fall to the floor. And seeing it completely throughout all of its phases, he wouldn't need to suffer when it falls to the ground. Or you might remember Thich Nhat Hanh's description of how we can see that a sheet of paper contains all things, from the sun which grew the tree, to the rain that brought soil nutrients to the tree, to the workers in the pulp mill. What stands out for me in this stanza, though, is the bodhisattva's explanation. What stands out for me in this bodhisattva's explanation, though, is not just the concept of nothing being gained or lost, but the use of the word tolerance. Forbearance or patient acceptance is also essential to understanding. Realizing that all things are impermanent can be pretty distressing. The people and things we love will be lost, so things are unreliable. Our practice points to the need to be at ease with the world and impermanence as it is. It's not about cutting off your feelings so that you don't care about the loss of those things, but about widening your perspective to contain all of the changes and all of the feelings, to open your heart. And it would also mean being able to hear others' pain when facing loss, and to fully hold it without running away. I think this would be the true realization of non-duality. So next, the bodhisattva Sriganda declared, "I and mine are two. If there is no presumption of a self, there will be no possessiveness. Thus, the absence of presumption is the entrance into non-duality." I think this response points to how a true understanding of non-duality requires awareness of how an individual self arises dependent on powerful influences that are actually from beyond the self: culture, history, genetics, economic circumstances, political pressures, upbringing, neighbors, teachers, friends, rivals, and so on. And this understanding needs to include the awareness that each of these influences can have a different impact on one's self-concept at different points of one's life. Earlier, I brought up the idea of how our practices tend to loosen our idea that we have a separate, unconnected self. For me, this first became more clear during meditation, in my early meditation practice, when I was able to actually observe my whirlwind of thoughts from a bit of a distance. In particular, an image arose in my mind of a graffito painting, which made me realize how narrow my concept of myself is. A graffito painting starts with a canvas, initially being covered with images or colors of all sorts, and then painted over with a single color, usually black. Portions of the solid overcoat are scratched away to reveal an image. What this suggested to me was that underneath the image I seem to have of myself, which is the scratched out portion in the black, is only partial. There's a whole brilliant swirl of paints underneath, of which I have little knowledge or recollection. So am I the single image scratched into the painting's overcoat? Or am I the mysterious, barely visible colors underneath? It has been a great antidote for me to how seriously I take myself at times. I hope I've become slightly less self-absorbed, and more open to seeing how my own suffering is tied to the suffering of the whole world. When I hang on to this you-me dichotomy, it makes it more difficult to talk to others about problems when they arise. The stories build up about why someone is not doing something I want or is doing something contrary to what I want, and then feelings of frustrations arise. You can see how the you, me, us, them, and me, or us versus the world, has been so unhelpful. It's painful both for oneself and the being on the other side of the equation. It can cultivate suspicion, mistrust, fear, and other feelings which obstruct open discussion and resolution of problems. So the beginning of enlightenment, perhaps, is not simply the freedom for oneself, but freedom from the self. But most everyone, I think, in the world struggles with this delusion of an independent self. Who out there realizes they're actually the drop of water in the wave of an ocean, which is also the ocean? As we become aware of this, it seems that our freedom from suffering will only end when we can all drop this dichotomy, and until then, open one's heart to the suffering of everyone and everything. All I can recommend is that we be patient with ourselves and with others in the meantime. Next is the Bodhisattva Shrikuta, who declared, "Defilement and purification are two. When there is thorough knowledge of defilement, there will be no conceit about purification. The path leading to the complete conquest of all conceit is the entrance into non-duality." And then I found that there was a similar statement by the Bodhisattva Simhamati, who declared, "To say this is impure and this is immaculate makes for duality. One who, attaining equanimity, forms no conception of impurity and immaculateness, yet is not utterly without conception, has equanimity without any attainment of equanimity, he enters the absence of conceptual knots. Thus, he enters into non-duality." The perception of things as defiled or pure or pure or impure has nothing to do with the thing itself, in my humble opinion. For example, we have bodies and we need to eat and drink. The result is that we also need to get rid of the wastes created during their digestion. So we defecate and urinate. They're just part of the system, and we wouldn't survive without them or without this process. Feeling disgust or aversion is a later step in the process and involves applying a judgment. This judgment is something extra, and while it probably had a function in protecting humans from becoming contaminated with E. coli or worse, the acts of eating and digestion are just necessary natural processes. I've been studying a book by Ben Connolly about Vasubandhu's Yogacara or Yogacara, which was an early attempt to resolve the differences between two early Buddhist philosophies. What's relevant to this discussion, though, is the step-by-step description of how awareness and feelings arise. Ben Connolly describes how this breakdown of the perceptual realm would have been done in meditation with experienced practitioners paying very minute and close attention to their minds. Modern neuroscience has discovered similar processes, and our teacher Kate has given at least one talk, if not more, about this neuroscientific research and its relationship to our practice, which I would recommend. You might have to talk to her about where those are located. What is described is a process where the body receives a sensation which takes mere milliseconds to be transmitted to the brain. Another few milliseconds might result in a reaction, perhaps to protect the self. It's not until after these steps have occurred that a feeling arises, and later one is aware of the feeling, like the dog poop you've just stepped in, which is after the body and brain have stepped into one's feeling. Like the feeling that one has after one has just stepped into dog poop. There, okay. The whole gamut of feelings and stories that follow have little to do with what actually happened. You just stepped in something. But they can range from, wow, this is really disgusting and stinks. The feelings and thoughts are extra. You might say, oh, why didn't I watch where I was going? Dumb me. Or why was the person who walked their dog here so careless as to not pick up after their dog? So it's not the action itself. It's not what actually happened. It's like all these feelings that happen afterwards that create suffering or constitute suffering. Okay, and this is a great name here. The Bodhisattva Pratyekasa Sardasana declared, destructible and indestructible are dualistic. What is destroyed is ultimately destroyed. What is ultimately destroyed does not become destroyed. Hence, it is called indestructible. What is indestructible is instantaneous, and what is instantaneous is indestructible. The experience as such is called the entrance into the principle of non-duality. I think this statement about destructible and indestructible could be a close cousin of the first statement about no production or destruction that I talked about earlier. This brought up some other thoughts for me, though, about how humans can hold two or maybe more contradictory thoughts and feelings at the same time. And I was reminded of this when I listened to Zoketsu Norman Fisher's talk about the Vimalakirti Sutra. In it, he recalls the time of Barack Obama's inauguration in 2009. This was a short time after his best friend, Rabbi Alan Liu, died suddenly. He was spending time with Alan Liu's family, watching the inauguration. They were all there, in complete grief over their loss, but at the same time, so inspired by one of the most awesome moments in recent American history. Norman says that later on, one could have watched the antics of the 45th president and said, wow, were we ever wrong to have felt such hope and inspiration? But he concludes that this would be an incorrect understanding. That moment of hope and inspiration is totally indestructible. Even when we're in the middle of a catastrophe, it does not wipe out the wholesomeness or benefit of a previous moment. It continues to exist and influence subsequent moments. One of my own experiences with the destructible or indestructible dichotomy was during the time of my father's illness before his death 10 years ago. I was shattered with grief, both for my father and others in my family. At the same time, my heart was so deeply moved by the care and compassion shown by caregivers, doctors, old family friends, and other members of my family. I can barely describe how this cracked me open to feeling the elastic power and indestructibility of the human heart. Not just mine, but everyone who came into this sphere of sickness and death. The sadness of the resulting loss of my father was the same, but the experiences of love and tenderness and being able to hold on to so many big feelings at once will always be there and has always changed me. And of course, in the wider world is the tragedy of climate change. Can we try to hold the tragedy, the impact that climate change is having on the world, especially to its poorest residents who are least able to do something about it? It's heart-wrenching. But it doesn't stop us from appreciating the garden in all of its seasons, rows of street trees, and the good work being done by so many organizations. The next statement. The Bodhisattva Pramati declared, "I and form are dualistic. To understand the I correctly and not to have attachment, aversion, or confusion with regard to form, that is called peace. Similarly, ear and sound, nose and smell, tongue and taste, body and touch, and mind and phenomena are all dualistic. But to know the mind and to be neither attached, averse, nor confused with regard to phenomena, that is called peace. To live in such peace is to enter into non-duality." So this sounds like what we chant in the Heart Sutra every week, doesn't it? And people who wrote later Zen sutras copied from each other liberally. It's like when a good idea is a good idea, you just copy it. When we think about the concept of sight, we usually think of the person seeing and the sight being seen as two separate things. The eyes of a person are needed for sight, but so too is light, form, time, space, the optic nerve, a brain, etc. So the sight of an object arises only in concert with the form and all of the other conditions that are necessary for seeing. And just as the eyes see when all of the conditions of sight are met, so too it is with hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. Thinking and emotions also rely on many connections. Nerve impulses and neurotransmitters and the brain are just the beginning of what seems to emerge as a thought or feeling. Nothing exists or is perceived in isolation from anything else. The Bodhisattva Khandratara declared, "Darkness and light are dualistic, but the absence of both darkness and light is non-duality." Why? At the time of absorption in cessation, There is neither darkness nor light, and likewise with the nature of all things. The entrance into this equanimity is the entrance into non-duality. Once again, do these words remind you of the chant called the Harmony of Difference and Equality? Here are the stanzas I'm thinking of. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. We tend to describe darkness and light as two separate things. But at what point does a day really dawn or dusk turn into night? The two completely interpenetrate each other. We also know that the sun or light is always there. It just happens to be on the other side of the world. Just as the senses and their object involve the interaction of many different functions and elements to occur, light requires darkness to distinguish objects. Darkness is only identifiable in its contrast with light. We differentiate between the two to have a more convenient way to describe things, but really, they have to operate together. Do you know where I am on time?
I'm fine.
Okay. I'm never too sure how long it takes. So the Bodhisattva Ratna Mudra Hasta declared, "It is dualistic to detest the world and to rejoice in liberation, but neither detesting the world nor rejoicing in liberation is non-duality. Why? Liberation can be found where there is bondage, but where there is ultimately no bondage, where is there need for liberation? The mendicant who is neither bound nor liberated does not experience any like or dislike, and thus he enters into non-duality." It's sometimes difficult not to detest the world, isn't it? It's so filled with sadness, violence, greed, and suffering. But the existence of this suffering is exactly why Vimalakirti committed himself fully to the suffering in the world. It is his reason for being a committed ally to ordinary people, homeless people, the addicted, people who haven't bathed in weeks, malnourished children, and so on. This description of non-duality is precisely the reason to focus one's attention on this world. Vimalakirti doesn't give up because he has seen through the delusional dichotomy between the pure and the impure. At one point, he says to his guests, "True bodhisattvas never dwell upon the least difference between the Buddha and themselves, or the Buddha and others. It is an awakened challenge to treat all people as if they were also Buddha." As Robert Thurman said in a talk given at Green Gulch many years ago, non-duality means being in the oneness of nirvana without forsaking the duality of the world. Recognizing non-duality is the basis for being able to offer compassion and healing to our distressed and messed up world. It's like the inseparability of our finger from our hand. They are two different things, but if you cut your finger, it's almost a given that your hand will pull back quickly from the blade of the knife. The hand doesn't say, "You should have been more careful, stupid finger." The hand helps by pulling away. It acts to pull the finger from danger. I'm getting close to the end here. So when the bodhisattvas had given their explanations, they all addressed the crown prince Manjushri. Sort of leave the best for the last. Manjushri, what is the bodhisattva's entrance into non-duality? Manjushri replied, "Good sirs, you have all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality. With these words, Manjushri cuts off any inclination to rest on one explanation to the exclusion of others. His words remind the bodhisattvas that there's no place for attachments to concepts or even to Buddhism. To not cling to an idea that any statement will provide closure or finality. Then the Crown Prince Manjushri says to the Lachavi Vimalakirti, "We have all given our teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality." He didn't cough. Thereupon, the Lachavi Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. The Crown Prince Manjushri applauded the Lachavi Vimalakirti. "Excellent, excellent, noble sir. This is indeed the entrance into the non-duality of the Bodhisattva. Here there is no use for syllables, sounds, and ideas." Vimalakirti's profound silence shouldn't be mistaken for other types of silence. It's not the silence of fright, confusion, wonder, or being embarrassed, as was Shariputra's when he turned into a goddess. Silence here has a special impact in its contrast to the many things that have already been said, both by the bodhisattvas and Vimalakirti. But it is also a silence that holds all of the wise statements about non-duality without needing to counter or refute them or improve on them. It reminds me of Mahakashyapa's enlightenment when Buddha held up the flower. Mahakashyapa saw it and smiled and was enlightened. I think Robert Thurman's words about Vimalakirti's silence offer a better explanation of this silence than I can provide. So I'll leave some of the final words on this statement to him. This is a footnote within Robert Thurman's 2017 translation of the sutra. He says, "This is the most famous moment of the sutra, Vimalakirti's moment of silence on the subject of non-duality or the ultimate. It is noteworthy, however, that Vimalakirti does talk a great deal about the ultimate on many other occasions. His silence here is given special impact by the series of profound statements preceding it, which culminate in the statement of Manjushri to the effect that silence is itself the best explanation of non-duality. All silence is not to be exaggeratedly taken as the profoundest teaching, but only such a silence in the special context of a profound thought on the ultimate. For example, the silences of the disciples in chapter 3 as they become speechless when confronted by the eloquent criticism of Vimalakirti are not taken to be profound, and nor is the silence of Shariputra in question by the goddess in the previous chapter. Thus, to imitate the sutra's pattern of expression, silence and speech are dualistic. Just as speech is ultimately meaningless, so silence exists in contrast with speech. Penetration into the equality of silence and speech is the entrance." So in the conclusion to the chapter, it's written, "When these teachings had been declared, 5,000 bodhisattvas entered the door of the Dharma of non-duality and attained tolerance of the birthlessness of things." Boom, they were enlightened. So hopefully some of you got there too. Before we leave this talk, though, I just wanted to say something about the miraculous room where all of this teaching takes place. I have a really visual imagination, so you know, I see various versions of this in my head. And this small bedroom somehow allows multitudes, thousands to be present, because Vimalakirti is just saying, oh, yeah, come on right in. There's room for everyone here. At first, this sounds improbable, and one imagines an impossibly crowded scene where one would not be able to turn around without bumping into an enlightening influence. And it made me think, but don't we live in a world where every atom we encounter could be the key to our enlightenment? Maybe those atoms are in the traditional hasu, a fist, a shout, or a staff. Maybe they're the atoms within the crowded field of one's body and inseparable from one's body. We won't know what the appropriate conditions for enlightenment are until they bump into us. They really are everywhere. Maybe it's the evocation of the inseparability of all things. It's just one big ocean and you're just a drop of water, but you're still the ocean. Or maybe it's just one big soup, and maybe you're the carrot, but you're still the soup. Thank you.